drive a decision about whether they're going to make a contribution or create a fund at the Oregon Community Foundation or contribute to that fund. Usually the events that lead to those kinds of moves are larger than what the standard deduction would have encompassed. So the concern, I think, about the standard deduction has been the more traditional nonprofit level kind of fundraising. The people who show up at the gala that Todd talked about and decide whether they're going to make a $500 gift or a $300 gift or a $100 gift. And there, where they can't now, because of the doubling of the standard deduction, necessarily count that and get any benefit for the contribution, what we're expecting and what the early data would suggest is it's not that people aren't going to give. I don't think people gave for the deduction anyway. But I think the amount they give may be impacted by the deduction. And so it may lessen the amount of the gift, not necessarily whether they give at all. And we do think it will have an impact, and we hope that Congress will be a little more thoughtful about that, because we do think it's lowering the amount of total charitable dollars that are going to be ultimately contributed to nonprofits all around the country.
Well, I hope that something happens to keep things going. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Max Williams, thank you so much, Todd Baker. Thank you very, very much for joining us today and helping us understand that you just don't have to be a billionaire corporation or a billionaire to be a philanthropist.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to also thank our intern, Shauna Muckle. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. Go to our website, insidewashco.org, to contact us or leave comments on this interview. This series is produced by Rick Paulson.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world, whatever time of day or evening it is. You are listening once again to Culture in Motion, your twice monthly show hosted by myself and my co-host, Ryan Danley. I'm Mike Shaw. What up, Ryan?
How's it going?
Man, you know, the apocalypse continues to look prettier and prettier. It just depends on, you know, how blurry your eyes are.
You know, I'm just excited because I've been pricing racehorses for that $600 that I'm getting. You know what I mean?
Like, you want to get a racehorse for $600?
Oh, yeah, it's a racehorse. Maybe a Ferrari, you know.
Right on, man. You got optimism is half the battle.
Is that what that is?
So for those of you that might be new to the show, we talk about music, culture, politics, and activism. This is where they intersect on Culture and Motion. And today we have a very special guest, Regina Rage, longtime activist out here in the trenches on the front line doing a lot. What's up, Regina?
What's up, Mike?
Chilling. Just trying to catch up and make sure that we make space for people who are doing the work, you know. We've got a lot of people that are coming to me, asking me, you know, I want a leader. I want to talk to somebody who's a Black leader or a Black femme leader and donate some money to the cause. And usually when that happens, you're one of the first people I think of, because every time I go out, you're there.
Yeah. I've been out there nonstop, I'd say. I did like have to take like a short COVID break, but other than that, I've been engaged in the movement in some way every single day since the uprising and the murder of George Floyd. And before that, like racial justice education was always something that I was engaged in and always something that I was doing in the community.
Okay. When you say always, how many years have you been engaged in the struggle for racial justice?
It started really like in elementary school. I went to an all-white elementary school And just having to be in that environment forced me to have to educate the people around me, and it put me in situations where I was dealing with blatant discrimination and bigotry, and often the abuse of that comes along with white supremacy.
Yeah, it's something I can relate to personally. I mean, growing up in many different environments, going from all black environments to mostly white environments. And so these struggles to kind of fit in, juxtaposed against our own identity struggles just to survive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Milwaukee, so that's home, huh? Milwaukee, Oregon?
Yeah, I moved there when I was like five or six. Mm-hmm. My parents were no longer able to take care of me, and I had to go live with my white grandparents. Okay. And growing up with white people raising me, having to really like learn about myself and come to terms with my own identity. Mm. and really developing a sense of worth, like in spite of like the trauma that I experienced.
Would you say that do you think that for somebody now growing up in that situation, like in Milwaukee or anything like that, you think there's more of an acknowledgement to that? You think that things are better, the same, or worse? Or
I would actually say things are the same. They're just, I think, more blatant and obvious because of social media and more attention because of the uprising. But it's always been there. It's always been happening. Mm-hmm. More people of color living in those spaces because they've been gentrified out of all black neighborhoods. And so I think that it's becoming more known, like the experience of a black person in Milwaukee is becoming more known and more recognized.
One of the issues that I've observed, and I never really quite know what to do with it, is this issue that comes up in terminology and people's understanding. And it's, some people think that Black Lives Matter is an organization. Some people say it's not. Some people think it's a movement. Some people think that it's been co-opted by George Soros. What is your orientation? Because, you know, I tend to think of people who are out here being active as people who are aligned with BLM, but some of us wouldn't say that about ourselves. Where are you at with it?
I feel like there is, you know, like a group like that was started by women called Black Lives Matter. But I think it's now become more of like a chant. And I think that it sometimes is co-opted by white people, especially here in Portland, because like the majority of our city is white. So, you know, most of these people coming out to protest are white people. And I do think they aren't always acting on behalf of Black lives. Like for me personally, I say Black liberation because this is a centuries long struggle. This has been going on since before I existed. My ancestors, you know, have been fighting this fight, and I'm just the legacy of that.
Come on, I can dig you. I really enjoy the fact that the initials for the Black Liberation Movement and Black Lives Matter are the same order, not just interchangeable. I think it did. I cracked this joke. Only a small percentage of my audience is gonna even smirk at this, but it doesn't stand for the Bureau of Land Management. You know, Bundy. around at some point in time, right? The elephant in the room. This is another one where people say, "How come it always has to be African animal?" The gorilla in the room. the hot story that's made national and even international exposure in recent weeks is the story of the Red House. Are you at liberty to talk to our listeners and explain what the Red House is and say more about your role in the struggle for housing justice over there? Or is that something that we can we talk about it in a way that's respectful and safe?
Yeah, for sure. I'm really proud to be involved in this. Okay. Actually, I was living in Northeast Portland, not very far from where the Red House is. And because of the issues that our community experiences, my parents got involved in drugs, gang violence. My house was taken over by Crips. And eventually the house was foreclosed upon and my family was never given an opportunity to get the house back. And my parents were given the resources to better their lives and have only very recently been able to get their lives on track. And I have experienced displacement a lot in my adult life as well, and I've been homeless with my children. And so when I learned about what was going on at Red House in Mississippi, I immediately wanted to become involved because there are so many people in our community that are facing the same displacement. And honestly, all of these issues are, you can trace them back to the white supremacy that exists in these structures that run our society. Okay. And the Kinney family isn't going to be the first or the last family that is forced out of their home or gets caught up in a predatory loan that they're not able to ever pay off. Like, these things are specifically designed to target Black and Indigenous people. And I feel like because this is something that happens a lot in my personal life and a lot in the community, it's my responsibility to work to stop it. So I started off just leading a march at the Red House. And that at that march, people in the condo across the way began throwing glass bottles at us and screaming slurs at us. And so I called some friends of mine and they showed up to help me guard the space while the event continued. And after that event, I was asked by the family and Koya to help come back and develop a plan to continue to guard the space and manage an occupation on the land to prevent prevent a police raid and hopefully keep the house while the family worked on negotiations. The entire time I was there, we haven't been able to talk to Roman, the developer, and he just wants the family out. And so the night of the raid, there was 100 plus police, and it wasn't just the police, it was sheriffs, it was ATF, it was feds, it was everyone.
Wow. So we appear to have lost our connection with Rage, but I'm gonna hope that Rage gets back on any minute. And in the interim, for our listeners, I just wanna break down a few things. I know there's a lot of people that live in Portland that understand what the Red House is. But there's going to be some people who don't know. And so, Rage, I'm going to just take a second, explain a couple things for people outside of Portland that might not know what the Red House is. Now, I live in Portland, and when I first heard the Red House, I thought they were referencing a Jimi Hendrix song. Okay. And the Red House is on Mississippi. But now, if we think about blues and rock and roll in Mississippi, we might assume that we're talking about the state of Mississippi. But Mississippi is actually a street, a thoroughfare that runs through an historically Black neighborhood in Portland, Oregon, a neighborhood from which hundreds of families have been misplaced by gentrification. So you were saying you were out there helping with direct action and a demonstration to keep people in the house. And you need, there was a mutual aid, multi-agency raid on the house with the county sheriff, the police, different federal agencies. And that's where you were at, Rach.
Yeah, and to go back to what you were saying really quick, the Kinney family, they were also a family that was displaced from Vanport during the Vanport flood. And they purchased the red house on Mississippi Avenue during their relocation from that. So they have a history of displacement as well. And on December 8th, I believe, almost 4 months of occupying the land, at 4:30 in the morning, multiple police agencies raided the property, arrested like 15 people who were camping on the land at the time, and including the Kinney brothers themselves.
What were the people charged with, and do you know the status of those charges?
Most of them were charged with criminal trespassing. There were people who were charged with having, there were people who had weapons. A gun was found, two guns were found, and body armor was found. And those are all like items that people in the crew used in for protection, for guarding the space. Right. And they won't be returned. Their items will not be returned. They also kept like personal belongings, like phones and anything that was on their person at the time of the arrest. Most of the charges have been dropped, but people are definitely like seeking legal counsel and beginning to protect themselves.
And it sounds like if people's personal property has not been returned, that there might be ongoing investigations potentially.
Exactly.
It's funny to see like that there's like creepy or weird right-wing rumors out there about it, like that they own another house in town, but it turns out that they're just staying at their grandmother's house, and that, you know, that it's just an odd, it's really become like ground zero for all of these other situations. How are the Kinney family holding up? Are they okay? I mean, it's to go be thrust into that level of spotlight is got to be unsettling, especially with the current temperature out there.
Yeah, the public is it's definitely split. Like some people are extremely supportive, and some people are doing everything they can to like criminalize the family and the actions they've taken to try to protect their home and their land. I mean, I kind of feel like it's inevitable, right? Like when Black people want to protect themselves in any way, white people stand up and say we're wrong for doing it. It's unfortunate and disgusting. And of course, like they're stressed and they're tired and they just want their house back. And along with like having an occupation with a bunch of people, you're having to learn how to deal with strangers, and there's a lot of interpersonal drama just like within that.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Yeah, housing defense is a very challenging undertaking. It's a form of frontline militancy that has to do with the basic human right of our right to be housed, our right to have shelter, and to exist in a safe space. And there were subprime loans and a lot of practices by banks that targeted poor people in communities of color for years and years and years. The housing bubble that was created numerous times over the decades created opportunities for people to get homes and get loans for homes. But what a lot of us didn't realize was that the interest on those loans and the terms of those loans were going to be fraught with almost undermined from the outset, in the sense that we were never going to be able to a lot of us were never going to be able to repay those debts. And so that was the way in which another land grab was waged on a lot of Black people who bought in the homes, who signed contracts, and then had those houses taken out from under them.
So it was like a horse before the cart situation. They were like, oh, well, we can make houses available for people. But really the problem wasn't that the houses weren't available. It was that the people weren't being supported by the world, you know, by the salary, you know, by the finances behind it to begin with. So regardless of just handing houses to people who ultimately can't afford it, the problem would be like, how do we make it so that we have a situation where people can actually like afford to live in houses? You know, it's it was really a terrible deal. Yeah.
And you know, the myth of home ownership, you know, what we talk about when we talk about home ownership is we're talking about at least six figures often of debt to a bank. And that's a lot different than ownership. You know, when I think of ownership, I think of something that's mine that you can't come take from me. But there are so many loopholes in these loans and mortgages that often people never own their house. You know, they're going into an amount of debt that they never recover from. So, Regina, are you familiar with previous housing justice efforts in the city of Portland?
Nothing to this magnitude. Uh-huh. I've never seen our city. I've never seen our city chase the police off like that ever.
Yeah.
Ever, or hold a blockade for a week and shut off access for almost a week. Like, there was no trash service, there was no transit. People could not get in to that area unless they unless we knew about it.
That's right.
I will say that video of the police being chased off is so powerful, and whether whatever comes of it, you know, I mean, things like that, like, it just, like, images like that is just like, I've seen it so many times, but every time it's like hard not to watch it. It's just like so powerful to watch, like, the power of people to be like, this is our space and you need to leave. So really big hats off to everybody there and holding that line, because that is for a lot of people who haven't been in those situations, that's scary and playing with live ammo. So hats off to everybody there for taking part in that, because I think situations like that seem to just, like, so much can be, like, anchored from just that, just the visions of that, you know.
Real talk, that the morale of the people is exponentially increased in some of these wins that aren't necessarily apparent if you're not there, you know. What does become apparent, like you said, Ryan, is the evidence of it can be a morale booster for other people. It can encourage people that militancy can work, you know. I just wanted to take a trip down memory lane and give a little history for our listeners. A big shout out to Poor People's Army in Philadelphia. Big shout out. They've got over, I think, 30 properties right now ahead of this moratorium. I've been involved with housing justice. I started in 87 in Minneapolis. We were taking over houses and putting houseless people into those houses, abandoned houses that HUD, Department of Houses and Urban Development, had left unoccupied. People were freezing to death and dying on the streets. So we were putting people in those houses and holding them. And then in Portland, between 2013 and 2016, there were about 5 homes that we took over, primarily for Black families that were being forced because of foreclosures, were about to be forced, evicted through force. And that's when we mounted a citywide campaign and successfully held at least 3 of those houses and worked 24-hour shifts, very similar to what you all are doing at the Red House. And I'm looking at the opportunities ahead and looking at previous struggles, and I'm anticipating we're going to have a nationwide housing justice boom in the weeks and months to come, because so many people are going to be facing houselessness due to the moratorium, due to being out of work because of the pandemic. Rage, where do you see the future of this movement, and where do you see your involvement in it going?
I've been talking about doing similar actions for other families. They said 45,000 people are facing foreclosure at the end of this. So I hope that the community keeps this energy and steps up to support those 45,000 people. I believe we could take back all the houses, and I think we should. I think the way that we're living is, it has to stop. You know, like hoarding shelter from people is insane. I don't know why we're allowing it to happen. And it's the people's responsibility to hold their government accountable. So if these past 2 weeks has taught me anything, it's that the work that we've been doing, it matters and it's effective, and we have to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. And I plan to be there the whole way. And if I do get caught up for some reason, I hope that I can find a way to continue to organize in those spaces as well.
What would you like to see from the people, or, you know, the people of Portland, and what is like your ideal scenario where we, to maybe the people who aren't down on the streets in that situation, where can we be of most use?
I think like reaching out to, I think it really, really starts with like just talking to our neighbors and seeing what people need. I think like, when you hear about a sweep that's going to happen at a houseless camp, like making the effort to go down there and keep those people safe during that sweep. I think like, as we continue to organize in our neighborhoods and this movement can get bigger and bigger. And like the easiest, simplest step would be just having conversations and finding out what the people around you need.
Sure. Is there any talk from, and I heard a rumor that the developer wants to give the house back or something like that. Has that actually reached any, has that bar any
fruit? Sorry.
What were you saying?
He's never talked to the Kinney family. The only time there was an interaction was when papers were served. We're still waiting to hear from him what his terms are. We've secured counsel, so we are ready to begin the negotiation. We raised the money. So it's like, it's really just like on him being willing to give the house back to the Kinneys. Right.
And if people who are listening that aren't involved, maybe people who are local and even some people who are not local, wanted to support the Kinney family, wanted to support the work you do, is there anything that we could tell them in terms of, is there a GoFundMe? Is there online? Is there a nonprofit? Is there anything like that?
Currently, we need help raising money to continue to feed the people that are occupying that space. So people can put money into the Red House Eats Cash App. That's $Red House Eats with the Z Cash App. And the GoFundMe is still up as well. The Kinney families do have a GoFundMe.
Is it like GoFundMe/Red House or?
Yeah.
Okay. Regina Rage, thank you for the work you're doing. And power to you and all the people holding it down and continuing this work.
For real.
Yeah. And thank you for coming on to Culture in Motion today. We're going to be on Wednesday mornings twice a month from 9:30 to 10 a.m. And we're going to be on air at kboo.fm. So thank you to our listeners, and please become a member of KBOO today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate y'all.
Right on. Peace, Ryan. Yep.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Kukatonin 2020, a commemorative Kwanzaa Kentu Fest on Thursday, December 31st from 9:30 a.m.